where we live on the island of Hawaii, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. There's often a very intense quality of the sense of fragility, of vulnerability, of living there, just not being part of a massive landmass, you know, kind of giant solid thing. And you look at the map and you see how far away everything else is. Or you just look out at the ocean in all directions and just have that very powerful sense of how isolated we are out there. You see often how there's a very palpable sense of how vulnerable we are to the changing conditions of life there. You know, a lot of it is about the weather. Very, very powerful changes in the winds, in the sea. The island itself is still growing, the active volcano on it, so the earth is always moving, and in some places very hot. So there's this very, it's very powerful, it's very humbling, and that has both the full range of, you know, things that that evokes, both the beautiful and the precious and the unique and the that sense of vulnerability, of lack of control, you know, really, really seeing how out of control a lot of these very fundamental forces are in our life. And there are times where, you know, it actually takes on a very, these very kind of exquisite and unique forms. And there's one that I've all, ever since moving there, have just been awed by, and continue to be, when the conditions are right. Usually it has to do with sort of sometimes when there's a lull in the trade winds, and then they sort of starting to come back. You know, that's kind of one of the most powerful forces of what's happening in the weather there, is the persistence, the presence or lack of presence of the trade winds. And when they start to come back, and sometimes maybe there's like the sort of counter sea breezes that are happening. I don't quite know what's going on in these moments, but where I am in the desert, in the very sort of dry part, you can at times look up at the sky, and not that far above. In fact, these trees, you know, not too much higher than the tops of the trees here. You know, these are very tall trees from the places I have lived, but not that tall for clouds. That if you look right around there, and maybe, you know, and higher, you can watch this process of a clear sky being there, and then suddenly a little wisp of looking sort of like smoke will start to arise, and the winds will be blowing, and it'll sort of like turn and toss, and slowly it'll start to kind of grow, and this sort of cloud formation will start to come into existence, seemingly out of nowhere, out of thin air. And you can just sort of watch this very immediate sense of change from the wind and moisture conditions, whatever it is, and just watch this, the birth of this small cloud unfold, and it's quite magical. And then as soon as they sort of come into some kind of basic, you know, coherence, just as soon as that starts to happen, they start to dissipate, right? The edges of it start to vanish and disappear. And it's, you know, all the while just sort of turning and turning. And then it sort of turns back into nothing. And you're back with the clear sky. And And it's I feel so fortunate just for that, just to have that opportunity of seeing something that I would perhaps normally see as something more solid, more stable, more powerful, more coherent, like a cloud, to have the opportunity to sort of to be there as it comes into being, as it exists, and as it disappears and dissipates. And it's helpful because, you know, often I can see, because it almost never rains where I am, you know, you can see sometimes storm clouds in the distance, and they're so massive and they're so powerful. And yet to watch it, you can see that, okay, this what I just saw is the same thing, right? It has the same quality as those massive things out there that seem so, such a powerful force of nature, these so ethereal. But because of particular conditions, we're able to see it in a different way, right? That this sort of invitation to a very different possibility of understanding what's going on in those other situations comes to light. And it's this kind of thing that is what we're doing here in our practice, right? Of starting to see that all conditioned things, all formations, right? Whether it's a cloud or our bodies or our thoughts, anything that comes into existence because of conditions will also dissipate because of conditions, those conditions changing. And that it's essentially anything you can conceive of has that same quality, including the mental conception of it itself. It's a very powerful and fundamental quality of all things that is a big part of what this practice is designed to help us have insight into impermanence, anicca. This constant change, this constant transformation of things arising, existing, and passing due to conditions. And there's what we start to see here in the practice is that there are both the conditions for things to change, but also the conditions for our ability to see it change, right? That we're sitting here in one sitting, or sleepy and grumpy, or, you know, feeling doubtful in ourselves or doubtful in the practice. Things sort of feel like they just sort of close up and have that sense of solidity and oppressiveness to them. And then for whatever reason, for whatever change in conditions, a few hours later, we have a sitting where there's a little more lightness, right? A little more levity, a little more energy, a little more equanimity has sort of perhaps showed up underneath everything. And you can see something that otherwise we wouldn't even be interested in. But you can see it in a very different light. Oh, this old friend of sadness might arise. And because of the causes and conditions of the mind that's watching, changing, we're actually able to see it in a very different light. And these subtler qualities that are not always so apparent become more apparent. And these conditions are, on one hand, not under our immediate control, and on the other hand, we do have some influence over them, right? That we can be cultivating mindfulness, cultivating concentration, cultivating interest, energy, loving kindness, compassion, right? We start to see that if you can incline the mind toward things, even if you can't necessarily make them happen, right? So that we're in this sort of process continually of trying to incline the mind toward conditions that are going to be supportive of us seeing things in a very different way, in a way that's not more or less true than we tend to see them necessarily, but much more subtle, much more difficult. So it's a part of their nature that is more difficult to see in our kind of normal frame of mind, but that all things share. And it can go, this quality of impermanence can, it can go either way. As you see in any given day, any given sitting, any given walking period, that there's the kind of anicca that we like, the kind of impermanence that leads to, and the bad things go away or the good things arise, and the kind of anicca that we don't like, right, where the good things dissipate, the bad things come. It's so basic, we make it so complicated somewhere I'm sitting here. And on a very fundamental level, it's why we start to incline also the awareness toward, do we notice pleasant, unpleasant, neutral in what's happening? Again, you don't have to force it. If it's not apparent, it's no big deal. Or we might not quite know exactly what we're looking for when we talk about that feeling tone. But you can start to see how, the arising of unpleasant, the dissipating of pleasant, the arising of neutral, the dissipating of neutral, all this actually is so much about how we evaluate if we think what's happening is good or bad. If our practice is good or bad, if we're good or bad yogis, if this is a good or bad practice. It's all just about this changing quality. And if one sort of particular quality seems to be more predominant for a longer period of time, we take it so personal, so make it so meaningful, and yet it's not, right? It's just conditions. It's just the fact of these things have unpleasant flavor. These things have a pleasant flavor. And of course, they're always changing. When we first arrived here a little over a week ago, I was walking down the beach and came upon a seal that had just recently died. And I didn't come upon it. I was walking and I came upon a big group of eagles and ravens and vultures all hanging out on the rocks. And clearly there was something. No one invited me to the potlatch. But I figured I'd go check it out. And there it was, this being that had died. And they were all being nourished by it. And you could see a lot of those beings, even the ones that maybe hunt a little more, a lot of them, most of the time, they're just kind of hanging out, waiting for impermanence to bring something along, The sense of nothing's here on the beach now. You can just see them looking, the eagles are kind of just, but there may be something soon, and they're ready for it, or the herons that are out there. It's this sense of they're hunting, but they're just kind of waiting for anicca to bring something along, and then going for it, grabbing it. And then, so I would visit each day just to sort of see this changing process of this body, of this this being, of the other beings who are feeding. And a couple days later, I went over earlier in the morning, and I was the tide was sort of out, and as I was there, I looked out, and there were three seals out in the water, had kind of come up and were just sort of bobbing, hanging out. And of course, you have that sense that, oh, this is their friend, or their relative, that other piece of impermanence, that sadness of loss, of that loss of connection. And something we care about no longer being there. It's very powerful to see this experience in the wild of both sides of that, right? The anicca of loss and the sadness around it, and the anicca of abundance and, food suddenly showing up magically. And then to visit each day, that it's a classic process. It's a classic practice in the text, in the tradition of mindfulness, of to go to the charnel grounds and to watch the body decomposing, to watch this process unfold. The thing that looks very familiar to less and less and less familiar. To watch the repulsion in the mind from the visual, from the notions that arise, from the smells, from whatever is happening, right? To watch that process of not wanting to see death, right? Not wanting to watch this kind of change, not feeling maybe that the heart is capable of staying connected to that process. It is very powerful, that the phrase that the Buddha encouraged in the Satipatthana Sutta when he said, go to the charnel grounds and watch bodies 2, 3, 4, 5 days old, watch what happens. And he said, to repeat this phrase, this body of mine also has this nature, has this destiny, cannot escape it. So we watch, whether it's, you know, a mammal that's, you know, that much closer to us. You know, you watch it with that, but you can watch it in the garden, you know, as the season starts to shift and certain plants come into bloom, come into blossom, other ones start to die. How do we relate to those kinds of changes? The sadness, the joy that arises from them. So it's this part of what we're doing in the practice, right? We're just bringing the attention to the breath and watching it change. Bringing the attention to sound, watching it change. Bringing the attention to any object. Bringing the attention to Michelle, watching her change, right? There are times where it can feel so distant from what we think might be important in life, right? There's all this stuff going on. There's all these things that are calling our attention. And what is the value of watching our breath? You know, what does this have to do with anything? And when you can attune to it, right, when you actually have some experience of seeing that change, you know, it's like watching this body, it's like watching the cloud, this understanding of like, oh, if you see it anywhere, you have insight into it anywhere, that insight permeates into everywhere, into everything, to seeing that, right, this is actually the nature of all things, birth, life, and death. Change, constant change. How do we relate to that? How do we relate to the breath? How do we relate to the beginning of the breath, the middle of the breath, the end of the breath? Can we ever really take it so that we know we will have a final breath? And we're often so arrogant about how far away we think that is, right? Can we relate to each out-breath as possibly our final out-breath? Can we relate to our in-breath as what it might have been like to be aware of our first in-breath, being born? That's how clearly, how carefully, how reverently we actually can watch this process. And it isn't just about our own birth, our own life, and our own death, but that of all things, all the beings we know and don't know, care about, don't care about, dislike. this constant change and our difficulty with it is kind of brings us into that next classical insight into the nature of life, the nature of phenomena, of things, which is this quality of dukkha. So, you know, all conditioned things are impermanent. They all have this quality of dukkha. Often it's translated as suffering or pain. But it's that it has to do with that quality of undependability and the hardship of that, of knowing that, you know, there are times we are joined with pain, and that is dukkha. That's called dukkha. Then there's when we're separated from what's pleasant, anicca dukkha, the dukkha of impermanence. There's a kind of dukkha, sankhara dukkha, the kind of very subtle and kind of subtle, but when we're in that place, deeply painful quality of just the relentlessness of things, right? The relentlessness of the mind, of formations, of just like that, this constant bombardment of sounds, smells, sights, tastes, touch, mind, right? This like this unending barrage of experience. Not to say that it's all unpleasant, or definitely not all pleasant or neutral, right? But the sense of, regardless of the flavor of it, just there's a weariness that can come from that tiredness of trying to keep up with it, you know? Because it's just always moving. There's always something to attend to. Something we're not seeing that's having its impact in the mind and the heart, the body. So, you know, we're trying to cultivate all this awareness, you know, kind of for each moment. And then suddenly, you know, every time you gain a little bit more capacity of mindfulness, you suddenly see there's so many more moments that you weren't seeing, you know. And then you see those, and then it just like this, it's like exponential process of just, wow, this is, no wonder it's hard, right? No wonder it's hard just trying to keep up with all of this. The mind isn't trained, and that's all it is, right? It's just that the mind isn't trained to be able to keep up with it. And so we can't keep up with it. Things start having their influence in the background. Unpleasant sensations start to sort of, you know, we kind of relate to them one way, pleasant sensation other ways. All this stuff is kind of happening, churning in the background because we can't keep up with it all. It's okay. You know, it's not, again, it's not personal. It's very hard. It's moving so fast. It's that this quality of dukkha that, you know, the Buddha said is inherent to all life, and it can be contorted as this kind of, you know, hopelessness and like a sort of negativity around the whole thing, but, you know, if you pay close enough attention, you get that it's there. You know, it's a big part of what's going on, and it's a big part of what can motivate us, you know, to practice and to try to understand what's going on better, to also feel more compassion for each other, for ourselves, seeing how hard it is just to sit here, never mind all the actual hardships we can go through in life, right? It's like, oh yeah, just sitting here is so hard. In these supportive conditions. You know, living in the desert, there's this, it's amazing because you, the times when rain comes, it is just, you know, it feels like it quenches this deepest place of just like, it's such a relief, and everything out there just feels like, these downpours that will come once in a while, you know, very rarely. And so there's just this happiness from that, you know, and everything feels alive, and there's humidity. And then, you know, you notice, okay, then, you know, a few days later, there's more grass around. It's like, oh, things are growing and everything's green. And then a few weeks later, that grass goes to seed, right? And so then there's all these bugs around and they're all eating it, you know. And then there's all these birds eating those bugs. And then there's all the cats eating the birds. And suddenly it's just chaos. It's like we're back in the jungle, right? Everybody's eating each other. Everybody's stressed out about food. Everybody's fighting for a place to live. And it's like, oh, right, life. A little bit of water, you know, just add water. And it's like, and then there's just like, okay, let's just, we'll let those guys over in Hilo have the water. We'll stay in the desert. Oh, yeah, it's amazing. There's also, so the, there's also, it's the you know, dukkha dukkha, anicca dukkha. There's also the third kind of dukkha. Sometimes it's also talked about also as just not getting what one wants. So, the you know, being joined with what's painful, being separated from what's pleasant, and then just not getting what one wants. And we were talking at tea time today. It was so funny because it was like this conversation about, as yogis, the times we might have been yogis ourselves at various retreat centers, how we manage the disappointment around certain, around food at different different moments, you know? So this sort of like, oh, well, at this retreat center, tea time is horrible. It's just like either there's no tea and you're just having, you know, you're not eating dinner at all. And so the sense of like you go down there just to literally drink tea and there's no food. The such utter devastation of that experience, you know, that you, that just like, I would just go for a hike and go for a walk and have some exercise to sort of stop feeling that, to avoid feeling that depression that can settle us over, you know, oh, just like there was one place where I would go. It's like, it would just be crackers and peanut butter and raisins, or crackers and tahini and raisins, right? Not even peanut butter. And it was just like, oh, you just dread it. You start to see the sun going down, and there's this moment of like, oh no, tea time is coming. And then losing appetite and just not eating, and then, you know, and then all what the complications that can sort of create, you know, or the other version of like feeling disappointed, but there's enough to work with that you make some like very complicated, combination of things. You're like, oh, I'll use the coconut here and the yogurt and the, and you make these like outlandish sort of treats for yourself, you know, to give yourself a little boost, you know, when you just see boiled eggs again, you're like, oh, you're raw kale, like for Michelle. And so you just, it's amazing these places where it can feel so poignant, and like, and that is a deep, that place on retreat in particular, because we're so protected from so many things around food, what it brings up around family, around our, so much, so evocative for so many of us, that it's often very hard. And so we find these ways of protecting ourselves from feeling those feelings, right? From, it's like the helplessness, the sadness, the longing, the wanting. It's so painful, actually, that we'll do all kinds of things to not feel it. And it's hilarious, you know, and we have to laugh at ourselves. And it's also very poignant. And also getting that, okay, part of this process is about renunciation. And about not ultimately avoiding that, right? If we know we're doing it consciously, we can do it skillfully, right? We can say, okay, right now, it's actually not going to help me to go to spin out into a depression around this for the nighttime. So I'm going to sort of like put some food away or whatever. Everyone figures out their thing, you know, their way to do it. But on the other hand, we're doing it. We're taking care of ourselves in that way so that ultimately we're actually building up the strength to be able to be with the pain, right? To not ultimately avoid it. But it's a very, around these more tender places, it's a very delicate process that we need to kind of be gentle with and appreciative of and careful with ourselves. And it's partly why, you know, it's like a place like this or many other places. It's why we love them too, because, you know, it's like you have cooks who are so happy to offer you food and to be making wonderful food for you, right? This sense of like pride that they have in it, the beauty of heart of offering to support your practice and the food, it's very palpable. You know, it's like, you know that the people here are very dedicated to you having a good experience, to supporting you here, and to having it be like, you can see that having a meal that has been carefully, lovingly, thoughtfully prepared, it brightens the mind, right? We receive that as dana, as generosity, as an offering of loving kindness, of metta. And it's like it is an important bolster of the heart. You know, it's why when we do this retreat in Burma, it's like, it's such a big deal. You know, we love the cook who basically teaches, right? It's like so much of what people learn there is like that the joy of his offering to us and wanting to support us in our practice there. It's beautiful and important. This year, the new Sayadaw who was teaching the retreat with Stephen and Michelle, at the end of the 10:30 sitting every day, he would be outside the hall and the yogis would come out and he would have a box of like cupcakes or donuts or like treats, you know, for people. And so you'd come out of this like, you know, you just... whatever, it's an hour-long sittings, you come out however you come out, you roll out, you crawl out, you know, you float out, however it is, and then like you've got Sayadaw there with a box of cookies for you, and it's like, wow, it's so brightening. Like, no matter what just happened, you feel grateful, you feel happy, you feel that sense of, you know, of uplift. That's important, you know, and everyone knows that it's important. And this thing of, okay, renunciation is also important. We bolster the mind, we strengthen the mind, we feel good. But it's also because we know that we can't control it all the time. And in that goodness, we develop the strength of mind, of heart, to be able to also be with the times that are more painful, more challenging, less pleasant. There's a story of Rumi's that I was reminded of the other day that that I love, about a guy named Munjun who decided he wanted to take that, you know, sacred pilgrimage to Mecca. And so it was his time and he was going to do it. And he was, you know, so motivated and pure-hearted about this pilgrimage, this journey he was going to take. And so he gets on his camel and he, you know, heads out across the desert. And, you know, he makes pretty good time every day. You know, he's sort of consistent. He's keeping the pace going. And then at night he decides, he just, you know, he sleeps on his camel. And he kind of rests and they, you know, settle down. And what happens is that the camel is not interested in going to Mecca. The camel wants to go home. The camel wants to be in its place with its camel friends, camel family, camel treats, and it just doesn't know what's out there. It doesn't like the desert, and it definitely doesn't know what's going on over in Mecca. So every night, the camel turns around and starts walking back home. So when he wakes up, he's halfway back home. And so he goes, you know, he spends another day trying to head back out. At night, the camel brings him halfway back, and he realizes it's going to take him 100 years to get to Mecca this way. And so he's like, okay, I have to just walk. I have to let the camel go. So he jumps off the camel and he sends it running back home. But as he jumps off, he breaks his knee. And that's basically what's happening here, right? This is the spiritual journey, right? This part of ourselves that doesn't want to be on a spiritual journey and doesn't want to work and doesn't want to be thirsty and hungry and do all this stuff, it tries to head back all the time, you know? It's just like, come on, let's just take it easy and, you know, whoa, you know, what is all this, you know? So there's this part of our own hearts that's like always pulling us back into our, it's this animal version of ourselves, right? That more sort of basic, fundamental place that we come from of just wanting comfort and wanting the things we want and wanting to avoid the things we don't like, right? Very understandable, very natural, but also not exactly the spiritual qualities that are going to get us there. So then we say, okay, we're going to let this go. We're going to have some renunciation. We're going to let go of our cell phones. We're going to let go of communication. We're going to leave our friends and family for some period of time, right? We're going to commit to this. And we send the camel wandering, but we jump off and we see, oh, we're wounded. We're injured, right? Our hearts have not been trained to do this work. It's very hard. And so that's the process. It's just like little, okay, how you get across the desert, the broken knee, it's like slowly, you know? Is that inspiring or what? Inspiring or not, it's there's a way that is how it is. And that is why it's like, okay, right, we're just taking very careful, small steps, right? It's like, actually, it's good to know we're headed in a direction, but this is what's happening right now. This is what we actually have to deal with, this body, this mind, these senses. And that's just how we get there, actually, is by very carefully attuning, paying attention, moving through space and time with this situation, right? And just step by step, one step at a time, one sitting at a time, one moment at a time. It's like that 1 acre, right, that we talked about last week. There's a whole field of everything, but you, all we really can know is this 1 acre. I realize that it's in Canada, they don't have acres, so it's 0.4 hectares. Oh, is it? Oh, I don't know. So just, if your metric, just you can still do the 0.4 hectares that you have. You do have acres here? That is so confusing. So you just, you know, you take a little. And the thing is we want to just take the whole thing, right? We want the heart to be able to just, you know, be kind of pulled open, ripped open, and just, you know, be exposed to everything and be able to handle that. And, of course, that is the direction we're moving in. But it's that's actually not how we do it. And that's actually not that important. I went to ophthalmologist a couple weeks ago. I had a weird thing happen, and so I went to check it out, and I'm fine. But when I was there, she's like, okay, we're going to dilate your eyes. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that means. And so she was putting the drops in, and then she was like, wait a minute. She's like, have you ever done this? And I was like, no. She's like, oh. She's like, do you have someone to drive you home? I was like, no. She's like, okay, well, your eyes, things are going to be really bright for a while, you know, like 3 hours. I was like, okay, all right, we'll just see, you know. So tests, blah, 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 everything's fine. And I go outside, right? And it's just like shocking, you know? And I put on the glasses that I have that are as dark as I would have ever thought were needed, you know? And it's just like, it's like blinding, right? How bright everything is. And so I get in the car, I'm driving down the hill, you know, just like squinting as much as possible with my glasses, trying to put the shades down, you know, just like trying to make it home and like as safely as possible with this, like, you know, because it's very bright sun down there. And it was so amazing. You look in the mirror and it's just like, you know, like a wild animal, you know, just like, oh. And it's true. It's like, that is, you know, this sense of like, oh, we would never fantasize about, oh, I wish my eyes were dilated all the time, you know, and just so I could just take in all the sun, you know. It's like, that's crazy, you know. That's, you don't want that, actually. It's horrible. It's a horrible experience. You actually are, we should be so grateful that the eyes know how to like shut down, you know, and that the motivation is, it's seeing, you know, actually being able to see. How, you know, just enough to see clearly. Isn't that enough? And so that's, you know, here we sit and we're just, we do have this, you know, dilation of the heart, the mind, around objects that arise, you know, that there is the time where it can be relaxed and it feels like it can open and see a lot. There's times where it's maybe more sensitive and needs a little more protection and it's closed. And it's, you know, that we don't trust our systems that are managing this process in its way. Again, not to say that our systems are powerfully wise or that we want to be, you know, beholden to the patterns of resistance or clinging that are deep within us. But again, it's like recognizing that they are there as a protection around what our systems feel like they can handle at any given moment. And that actually it's watching that process, watching the opening, watching the closing, watching this unfolding of the process that actually allows us to see clearly what's happening. Sadness, resistance, doubt, heat, pressure, warmth, lightness, tingling. Some emotional, mental qualities those things evoke, a painful memory, a pleasant memory. How the mind wraps around and relates to all those things. It really is like an inflammation, you know, that our body responds to injury, to infection, to some kind of pain with this inflammation response, you know, that goes to try to attend to whatever injury has occurred, you know, and it is very similar to what happens with the mind, right? When there's some kind of experience of wound, right? In the mind, in the body, that the mind has a sort of inflammation response, a sort of swelling up, a reddening, they have these, you know, the qualities of inflammation, pain, heat, redness, swelling, loss of function. There's a way that happens in the mind, right? When something really evocative happens, when we're really turned up around something hard, even if the experience seems simple, right? It was just like a slight disappointment that happened. It might be very subtle, but we see it has a very profound impact on the heart. And so this sense of, oh, right, this fieriness, the lack of function that happens in the mind, it's a response to a wound, you know. It's not, it's understandable. Sometimes it actually works. Sometimes it really helps, right? Clean the site, protect the spite, go, you know, start healing some places, because it knows we actually need a little bit of sort of protection from something that's so evocative, so powerful. Just inflammation of the mind. Chitta-itis, you can call it. You just note it, right? Chitta-itis. And so you don't, you know, this sense that we need to fight against our habitual response, sometimes we do need to protect against it, right? If it's a particularly volatile response, yes, it's like we have our precepts. We have plenty of structures in place to prevent from the most kind of gross manifestations of an unskillful response, right? And yet, the subtler manifestations of it, okay, we're here to actually to explore it, to understand it, to be interested in it, not be beholden to it, not try to act out of it, be very careful about the places that it takes our minds and our hearts, but also not just shut it down, right? Start to sort of see. And then, of course, we do this protective thing. We try to understand what's really happening. We start to see, is this necessary or not? You know, we do all the processes we need to around starting to settle ourselves down, giving ourselves some space, going for a walk, taking a break. If something is really up in an intense way, we back off. We learn to let the system sort of settle down, because that's like that chronic inflammation is a problem, right? If we're always like that, actually other things start to sort of come into play that can cause all kinds of problems. So it's like, yes, it can be a healthy response and it can go overboard, and we need to be careful about that. And then we get to the next insight, anatta, non-self. And the reason this ends up being related has to do with this question of defense that we see, our this relationship to the undependability of things, to the constant change of things, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, the this aspect of life that can be so hard, that our response of clinging, our response of aversion, our response of delusion, and all, you know, all of the hindrances of sleepiness and doubt and restlessness and worry, that they're all trying to defend ourselves from a perceived threat. And then as we watch closer and closer and closer, we start to see that actually there, things are not a threat, because there is no coherent self. Right? So that we're trying to defend ourselves. But when you start to watch more closely, we start to see again, it's like the clouds. It's like, oh, right. All of this thing that we think of as this very solid, very permanent, very stable sense of me is really just as fluctuating as anything else. That it's actually just as incoherent, just as ethereal, just as changeable as a cloud. And so that's when that defense is no longer needed, right? The sense of like, oh, that when there is insight into non-self, there isn't a need to protect this thing of a self. So that inflammation response doesn't happen, right? That these other things aren't engaged, they're not triggered into effect, because there is not this understanding of, oh, this thing that we think is so solid is actually just, again, a congealing of causes and conditions that are constantly unfolding. Now, that experience, it can look like a million different things and can actually be very subtle. It's always important to just remember, oh, we might have a thought of, okay, the experience of non-self is this, but it's like all with all of these things, dukkha, anicca, anatta, even mindfulness. What is mindfulness really? We might have a notion, but why not just explore what it might be? Why not just explore what metta is, rather than just saying, oh, I need to feel this way? What are the What is the spectrum of kindness in the heart? What is the spectrum of this sense of self, of meanness? And you can, you'll have plenty of chance to watch it. You could watch, you could just watch that all day, and it would be fascinating, right? When your sittings and your walkings, in the in-between times, this persistent sense that there's this me watching all this, managing all this, operating within this, right? Like somewhere back, a couple inches behind the eyes, you know, pulling the levers. And that is a very reasonable belief, because that's how it feels most of the time. And so it's not like we're trying to get rid of that experience. It's not trying to say that's wrong, and you know, that because, you know, that's based on a delusion, we need to sort of eradicate that notion. It's like, well, no, that perspective is based on certain conditions being present. And with different conditions present and qualities of the mind present, a different perspective arises, which is that, oh, we're sort of just these little tornadoes spinning around, you know? Or just there's a moment where something happens and it feels like, oh, I notice kindness, I notice the intention to move, I notice the physical sensations of moving, and nowhere in that was there a sense of me that happened. And it could just be while we're reaching for a spoon. You have to trust the subtle experiences of these things, because these are actually happening at a very subtle level, right? That it's not just this sort of big, oh, liberation from the total bonds of this experience of self. That may happen, but it's also happening out on these very subtle levels. And that is to take the fruit of that when it happens very seriously. I really encourage it, you know, that exploration without an agenda, without looking for some kind of experience, but just watch, you know, every so often tune in to like, okay, where is the sense of self right now? What does it feel like? Just look for it. Where is it? Where does it reside? What part of what's happening does it feel like it is, you know? Just check it out. Just explore it, because it's actually fascinating. Wonderful. You know, this deep ability of ours, and to take a stream of events and turn it into something that we can identify and name and, you know, have a belief about and have stories about. It's a beautiful part of the human capacity, and also not always necessary. You know, I think about if any of us were in a room and just dumped a garbage can full of Legos on the floor and sat there for an hour, it would be hard to not start building something, right? There's like a deep propulsion in the heart to just start making things out of things if the pieces are there. And what we're just saying here is like, watch that, watch how we make a world out of a sound. Watch how we construct an identity around a pain in our ankle, a sound that comes from our stomach, right? It's like, watch this process of constant creation, conjuring that the mind is doing around experience, and just be interested, because it is incredible. It's amazing. And there's a part of it that is exhausting, that is tiring, that is withering. You know, this, if there was a constant self, if there was a coherent self, you wouldn't get lost in thought. You would say, I'm going to watch the breath, and you would watch the breath. But in fact, that intention to watch the breath happens, the awareness moves to an area here, and then the next moment, there's a new intention to think about our dog back home or something we saw on TV, right? It's like that self is gone. Whoever that was that wanted to watch the breath is gone. And there's this new thing that's like really interested in something much more interesting than that, you know? That's all we're saying, you know, that of course there are coherent qualities to that, familiarities to those patterns over time. But it's always changing. It's always moving. It's always shifting. And that process of watching it is actually a process of liberation, of not needing the self to be there or not be there, but that that whole range in between is like, okay, right, this is just like anything. It arises and passes due to conditions. The ability to see it in a certain way arises and passes due to conditions. Mahasi Saira talked about in this one book I have, reassuring the reader that it's still okay to say me and mine, even if we know there's no self ultimately. And he said, you do it just as in the way you might call someone who's not a blood relative, you might call them uncle or auntie or son or cousin. Just in that same way, you say me, you say mine, right? You call yourself your name. It's so beautiful, right? That's, you can see, it's not the sense of like, oh, we should hate this fabrication of the mind, that we need to get rid of it because it's a problem. It's like, oh, it's like a, you know, a close family friend that you feel that sense of connection to as if they're family, even if maybe they're not technically family. Right, it's like, yes, maybe there isn't technically a coherent self, but of course we are ourselves. Of course we love ourselves. Of course we care about our own happiness. Those things don't need to be mutually exclusive. So just, you know, just take good care. And you know, we're so happy seeing you all practicing and being here with you all, and just feeling like it's, you know, it's always so inspiring, and you all in particular are very inspiring. It's wonderful to be here, and I just, you know, I know I speak for all of us of just this enthusiasm and sense of gratitude and just good fortune that we have to be here together doing this practice, as hard as it is sometimes, for sure, you know, and to know, you know, you can't be careful to evaluate what's happening in any given moment of, oh, this is good or this is bad or this is, you know, it's just like, you don't know. You just, it's like, even if you see mud clearly, it's still mud, you know. It doesn't become clear. We're seeing these parts of ourselves that are harder to see sometimes. And that's their nature. That's what they are. We're still seeing it clearly. Feel good about that, right? Feel good about what you're seeing. You're seeing a lot. It's not always what we hope for, but it's all good, you know? And just remember that, yeah, there are times where it's too intense and we're overwhelmed and we're at our edge and we need to, you know, take a break, step back, have a treat, right? What's a retreat without a treat? Once in a while. Pinheiro, he said, where there's tea, there's hope. Just remember that when you're going through a tough spot. Let's sit for a minute.